Welcome to the Just Fly Performance Podcast, episode 22. Today on the show, I have Matt Van Dyke, Associate Director of Sports Performance for the University of Denver. Today's episode is brought to you by Simply Faster. Simply Faster is an online athletic performance technology shop distributing items such as the FreeLab Timing System, GymAware, K-Box, 1080 Sprint, and the SpeedMat. I've gotten many of these items from Simply Faster and can confidently say that they make today's best training technology available to everybody. The FreeLab Timing System has revolutionized both my practices and my athlete assessments, allowing me to look at the 10-meter fly capability of dozens of athletes in a matter of seconds. It is wireless, compact, portable, and incredibly versatile. The K-Box and 1080 Sprint are fantastic tools for any coach looking to build speed, agility, and implement training scenarios that go beyond the traditional weight room. The 1080 Sprint is being used by great coaches training some of the fastest sprinters in the world, and it truly represents high-performance speed training. I can personally attest that Simply Faster's customer service is second to none. Christopher at Simply Faster responds quickly to queries, and anyone who makes a purchase from Simply Faster is in good hands. If you want to acquire some of the best high-tech training equipment available, stop by simplyfaster.com. That's simply with an I, faster.com. They are the future of coaching technology. Welcome to the Just Fly Performance Podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in with us today. Episode 22 here, we have Matt Van Dyke of the University of Denver. Matt is one of the emerging and brightest young strength coaches in the industry today. At 27 years old, he's already written two books and has also been mentored under some of the best strength coaches of our time. Before he was at Denver, he spent 6 months under Cal Dietz at the University of Minnesota. I first heard about Matt through the Triphasic High School manual, but more recently, Matt sent me a copy of his glute layering model, which you'll find in Triphasic Manual for Lacrosse, which, by the way, that isn't just for strength coaches who are in lacrosse. That book is global. Any field sport, or to be honest, anyone who wants to learn how to prevent injuries in athletes, soft tissue injuries, it's an amazing resource. So even if you don't work with lacrosse, great piece of information to pick up there. So with the glute layering, though, Matt's taken things all the way from the structure and alignment of the athlete all the way on down to three-dimensional contralateral training to create a glute system and hierarchy, which he'll explain a little bit in the podcast today, that has really just slashed soft tissue injuries at the University of Denver. And you see a lot little bits and pieces of glute training and glute preparedness here and there. You'll see some activation drills, you'll see high intensity drills, but nobody has put it together the way that Matt has. And things like what he is doing with lacrosse at the University of Denver have applications to nearly any sport in terms of getting the neuromuscular firing locked in and then providing science-based isometric work in appropriate dosages. You're going to learn a little bit more about what the appropriate dosage actually is. It's a lot more than you think. And then going into how do I infuse that into the movements of sport, which is not just sagittal plane, it's in multiple planes, as Matt is going to give a ton of great relevant examples of how to program that. We're also going to get into some of the ideology on Olympic lifting. They don't do it at Denver. They don't really do it in Minnesota, as to why and what does the rate of force development look like in a clean and how does it fit in the context of the triphasic model. And then we're going to get into triplanar loading and a lot of ways to get more specific with your athletes and what they're actually experiencing on the field. And being able to do that with a level of intensity that's appropriate for actually overloading the system in terms of muscle contraction and coordination. So if you're listening in your car or on the go, please be sure to also check out the webpage associated with this podcast. There's lots of great show notes that have videos of some of Matt's exercises he talks about during the podcast. With that said, let's get to the show. Hey, Matt, thank you so much for being on the show today. It's great to have you here.
Thanks, Joel. Thanks for having me.
All right, so before we get started with the questions, everyone who's listening at home, let's just have you share a little bit of your background. Where have you been in the world of strength and conditioning? What coaches have you worked with, and where are you going?
Yeah, I started actually in college playing sport. I was a football player at Iowa State. I was there for 4 years. And while I was there, I was fortunate enough to have my strength coach be Yancey McKnight, who's down at Houston now with their football program. So played there for 4 years, got a really good feel for the weight room. I remember the first time I walked in there. At that point, I was kind of undecided. I knew I was really interested in the human body and its and how it responded to different things. So I was looking into pre-med, pre-PT, all those things. And walked into the weight room in the first day there, and I said, "Oh, this is it. This is what I want to do." So luckily, I kind of figured that out early. But through playing a sport, you don't get the chance to do a ton of internships. So luckily, he got to play a big role, which is awesome because he's an amazing strength coach for those 4 years while I was there. When I was done there, I continued on with an internship there for another semester. So finished in the winter and then interned there in the spring. From there, got the opportunity to go up and intern at the University of Minnesota under Cal Dietz. Obviously, got the chance to begin working with the triphasic training system, and from there moved to St. Cloud as a graduate assistantship role. So at St. Cloud, I got the opportunity to work with quite a few different teams there. It's a small staff, and it gives you a huge opportunity to implement some of the training principles that maybe I'd seen for the last 5 years at that point, into an actual system that you get to make your own. Left St. Cloud a little bit early, finished my master's a little bit early, and went right back to Minnesota with hockey and Cal at that point. So kind of perfected, I guess you could say, the continuing triphasic and how it's progressed through the last about 12 to 15 years at this point. And from there, I was only with Cal full time for a short stint, about 6 months or so, and then ended up over here at the University of Denver as the associate director. So I've been here now for the last year and a few months. So it's been a wild ride, I guess you could say, the last few years moving from place to place, but it's been exciting to see myself grow. And obviously, with the opportunities to work with exceptional strength coaches in the past, has really shaped the programs that I'm implementing today.
Matt, that's awesome. And it's always great to see where young and upcoming strength coaches have kind of cut their teeth. So, first question I'm going to ask you, Matt, for the show today, the debate on Olympic lifting, whether or not to use it in your program or not, and then what are some variables that we need to consider? I know that you at Denver, that you guys don't use them, and that you've also done some research in rate of force development and the Olympic lifts and sprinting and jumping and how that all fits together. So could you share with us your philosophy on that?
Here at the University of Denver, we actually don't use any Olympics at this point, ultimately with the goal of transfer of training for our athletes and the amount of time that we get with them, especially being on the quarter system. We've moved away from them quite a bit, and really it came down to, for us, for five reasons is why we've done that. The first is the technical requirements of the movement itself. The time to proficiency with that, like it is an Olympic sport in and of itself. So to say that you have to be a great clean or a power clean or hang clean, whatever it is, in order to progress in your own sport, we just don't feel that that's a necessity in that aspect. The other thing is, like I mentioned, we're on the quarter system here at Denver. So we have 10 weeks. We start school later than most schools. We started this year, I think, around the second week of September. I think it was like September 14th. And then we are out for like our winter break begins in 2 weeks. So we only get 10 weeks in the fall with them, and then they get 6 weeks off for their winter break. So for us, if we have athletes that say go back to wherever they're from, if they're an out-of-season sport, and they don't have the platforms, things like that, then they don't have that training available to them. So it wouldn't make sense for us to train somebody to be not only proficient in that movement, which would require time, like for a lot of our kids, it could take up to that 6 to 8 week mark just to get them fully proficient in the movement, and potentially even longer, and then have them leave for 6 weeks, forget everything that we've done, and then start back at square one when they return, like the first or second week of January. A second reason that we've kind of shied away from them is the reduced range availability for actual force training of the movement. So if you're looking at an Olympic movement, that there's absolutely no doubt there's a ton of power created with it. But it is when an athlete's technically proficient in it, like we just discussed. But it's not an absolute strength movement, because otherwise it would be a deadlift. Like, your athletes have to be able to move the bar fast enough to get it to a range where they can pull themselves under the bar. And it's also not an absolute speed exercise. So unless the bar is released, or if you're trying to do an extremely light power clean, you could end up hitting yourself with the bar, because you're trying to move it with those high velocities required in order to improve that speed range or quality. So for us, fitting into the block periodization model that we use, with the idea of that we're just going to choose one quality. And for us, being on the quarter system, we start with either our energy system development or strength, unless a team is going right into in season. And then we progress into power and then into speed. So with our transfer of training model, going from can our athletes produce high levels of force, and then progressing down that force velocity curve to can our athletes now produce high levels of force extremely rapidly, the Olympic movements piece would really only fit into that power section. So it wouldn't make sense for us to change up a movement entirely and go from our strength, and let's say it's a back squat or it's a safety bar split squat like we use here, and then all of a sudden go to Olympic movements for our power, and then all of a sudden we go to speed and it's either a double leg jump or a split squat jump, respectively, depending on what we used in the strength block. So for us, it comes down to that transfer of training piece and what's going to give our athletes the greatest benefit on the field. And especially with that technicality piece playing an important role, as we discussed as our first point, we just don't see that as fitting the model that we provide. The third reason is the muscle action piece. And obviously, being a triphasic guy, working under Cal, seeing the benefits of that. I actually did my entire thesis on the effects of triphasic and rate of force development. We've gone away from it because it doesn't fit that model, is as well. Like, it doesn't fit. It's hard to do unless you're going to do an eccentric hang clean from the floor, like a power clean, that you're not going to have it. And you get a little bit when you catch, yes, but it's such a short range of motion that you're actually eccentrically decelerating in an isometric position. And then you have to look at, is that position really an athletic stance that you can put an athlete in, that you want them to be strong in on the field? Because we know with those isometric movements that athlete can only produce that newfound force within a certain range. It's about plus or minus 10 degrees from their current body position that's producing the force. So is that isometric or eccentric range going to transfer to what they're trying to do on the field? Another thing, and we'll cover more about this as we go, but Olympic movements are done in a single plane. It's from the floor to your catch or to your pull, but there's no rotation, there's no frontal plane, it's all sagittal. And here at Denver, especially with the glute layering model that we're going to go into some 3D training that we've completed to try and get a joint by joint approach, that Olympic movement takes that out of it. Now, that doesn't mean you can't do your Olympic as your major and then do multi-planar work later. Like, the majority of our major movers are not completed in any other plane than sagittal, just because you lose the ability to produce extremely high levels of force when you start to change those planes up. Our goal is to ensure that our athletes can transfer skills, whether that be the understanding of how to proprioceptively feel each of their joints completing a movement that might be required on the field. Finally, and this is the piece that you were discussing earlier, the work that I've done with a little bit of force plates on them, and take this with a grain of salt, because it's self-done study on myself and then a jumper at the University of Minnesota. But throughout my college career, as well as his, Olympic movements were completed. So we always use some type of power clean for our major mover, and then maybe a hang clean on days where we weren't using power clean as a dynamic effort. So we felt we were pretty proficient in the actual movement of the Olympics, good technique, things along those lines. But what we found was pretty interesting. We compared a power clean at a relative max compared to a weighted squat jump and then a squat jump itself. And what we ended up seeing is that although the power clean, it takes a little bit longer to occur, obviously, than a single jump, but it never reached the same height of an impulse as the jump. So if we're thinking about running, if we're trying to transfer extremely high levels of forces in extremely minimal times, that rate of force development curve or that slope is going to be extremely steep. And what we saw with our power cleans compared to our jumps is that that slope isn't quite the same. So what could be used as that power movement, as we discussed earlier, or force production, not maximal or speed, but it can be utilized to produce power. So what we ended up seeing is even though that impulse, that high impulse, was never seen with our power cleans, due to the duration of the time of the power clean compared to the jump, the actual total force produced, it was higher in the power clean. But if we're considering what can our athletes take to the field, I think it's critical that we train with that singular high impulse that those jumps give us. So for that reason, that kind of backed up the mentality of moving towards using the jumping over the power clean to improve that rate of force development. It ended up leading right into the thesis that I completed of triphasic and its effects on rate of force development. But seeing that from two athletes that would be considered fairly proficient in the clean in the Olympic movements was pretty eye-opening for me, and started to really begin my progression to taking them out. Because if after 4 years, I can still get myself to produce a higher singular impulse within a jump than through a clean, then why would I spend my time trying to train an athlete for 4 years if I can get them to jump proficiently in a much shorter amount of time?
Yeah, I think that's a great point, Matt. I always love people talking about the finer points of the Olympic lifts. It's easy to say they produce a lot of power, but I don't think a lot of people go into the nuts and bolts and say, okay, well, how and where and what's the force time curve on it, and how does this look like compared, you know, in terms of dynamic correspondence. Something I talk about every now and then is when my best year in track and field, when I high jumped 7 feet and my other years were more around 6'8", is my clean was actually down that year by a good amount. I didn't train it as much. I didn't take it as seriously, but all my plyometric efforts and some of the more specific range squat type movements were a lot better. And so I'm glad you kind of quantified that for us. I definitely think it's a tool that certainly has a great use. I do use it myself for half my teams. But yeah, just knowing why and knowing what the actual components are is awesome consideration. Go ahead, please.
I was just to say, and that's exactly it. Like our situation, based on the multidimensional movements that we use, as well as our timing with the quarter system, it just doesn't fit our model. There are situations that it can fit. Like if you have one-on-one time with an athlete and you're working on just their power production and you get to do that for an extended amount of time, then it could fit your model. But ultimately, like you're saying, you have to consider what we have to do as college coaches in a matter of maybe 8 to 10 weeks before our kids disappear for a while. And what can we do to ensure that they still have certain qualities that we need when they return?
Yeah, no doubt. Yeah, it's all got to go in the it's all in context and in the context of the system. Matt, the next piece I want to talk to you about, and it was especially within your new book, The Triphasic for Lacrosse. I know you go into this, and it's just such an awesome game changer. And I guess I'll spearhead that whole topic with just talking about compensation patterns in movement. How do athletes pick up compensation patterns? What are they? And then are there things that we can do in the weight room, generally speaking, to ensure that athletes aren't picking those up or proliferating those?
Yeah, and that's a pretty complex, loaded question. And really, there's no way of knowing entirely why these patterns are occurring. We think that we have a pretty good idea based on some physiology responses from stressors or things along those lines. But ultimately, we've come to the thought process that these compensation patterns that are occurring within your athletes are gonna boil down to kind of two situations. It's either a structural issue or a stressed issue. The body has gone into a defensive mode instead of an attack or perform mode. And with that comes the starting of shutdown of certain muscles, and we can kind of get into that as we go. But the structural piece with athletes that sit in class all day, all of a sudden we end up with maybe an anterior pelvic tilt, or their hips just become inappropriately height-wise, need to be reset, things along those lines. And we're fortunate enough here that we work with a chiropractor just down the street that's unbelievable, fits in with all of this basically applied kinesiology that we're applying. So he's been on board and been a huge part with some of these things. But with that structure becoming an issue, the body's just not going to allow high forces to be created. It kind of goes into a protective mode, or you have muscles that maybe enter spasm because they're bracketing themselves in order to protect that joint that might not be functioning to its highest extent. So looking for us, we look at hips pretty often, and we've started to use some a mixture of some PRI and some of these other things as well, such as the RPR and then the rest of the glute layering model too. But the PRI has been instrumental if you're not allowed to touch your athletes as a strength coach. And obviously, if you're doing any of this, you better be on the same page as your athletic trainer to make sure that you guys know what is going on and where the line is, because here at Denver, like I said, we're in a really good spot here where we're allowed to do some of these things that maybe other athletic trainers aren't comfortable with other strength coaches doing. So I think it's really critical that you check in before you ever try any of this stuff or begin to implement some of these restructuring pieces. But until that structure is adjusted and corrected, say it's hips off or whatever, that the entire chain is basically going to down-regulate to make sure that it can't hurt itself. It doesn't want to, like a groin is an easy one. If hips are off, or maybe SI, like we talked about, is rotated just slightly. It doesn't have a lot of room to move, but it still should move a little bit. And if it gets locked up, that groin is going to start to experience a down-regulation or some inhibition. To make sure that it doesn't put itself in a spot where it can get injured, and you can see patterns arise from that. The second is stress, and we see it all the time, like with fight or flight. We see these stressed athletes turn into defense positions, like I was saying earlier. The body has all of its important organs at the front, and you see these stress positions where the athletes are hunched over because they're constantly stressed, and part of that goes right back into the structure too of sitting in class all day. And what that will do is that will start to mess with that length tension relationship in your body, and from there your body is intelligent enough, it's gonna find a new way to do things. So it's gonna find out how to do things. It's gonna find your body has to do two things to survive. It has to breathe, and it has to move. So it's going to always find a way to move, and it might not be done in the most efficient and correct way possible. And as soon as that occurs, your athletes are much more likely to sustain an injury. And along with that stress, I mean, we always explain it to our athletes in a fight or flight versus rest and digest, or sympathetic or parasympathetic, as we know. But we want to make sure that our athletes understand what's going on. So we talk about like a type A personality. So we compare someone that's a CEO versus someone that is some guy hanging out on a surfboard on the beach. Like the CEO guy is extremely stressed all the time. And we discuss how your brain, like going back in ancestry, is set up as soon as the fight or flight model is, let's say you walked outside and you see a lion, like you're immediately in a fight or flight. You're experiencing a rush of catecholamines, like different enzymes to ensure that your body can either, it's trying to survive, it's in survival mode, it's either going to run away from that lion or it's going to fight it. And when you're experiencing that back in those times, every time that occurred, you're also completing some type of physical exercise. Well, nowadays, our athletes experience those same stressors, but we get it in completely different ways. We get it on social media, we get it through email, we get it through, and it bombards us nonstop. So you get these athletes, like we always joke that they're sitting in the library and their biggest stressor is how many likes their Instagram photo gets. And as soon as they get stressed about something, their brain flips into that fight or flight mode and their body's producing a rush of catecholamines, just like if their ancestors walked out and saw that lion standing there and they had to decide whether they were going to run away from it or fight it. Well, without those athletes just sitting there, they're no longer completing some type of exercise, basically fight or flight, to clear all those catecholamines. So as those are produced over and over and over again, our athletes get stuck in this sympathetic state. Well, all of those catecholamines have to be cleared out at some point, and our body does that through our lymphatic system. Well, that lymphatic system basically works to be cleared. So as those, like you have lymph nodes throughout your body, and this is all the way back into applied kinesiology. I think it was produced in the mid-70s. It's like Chapman's reflexes, things along those lines, neurovascular, neolymphatics, and as those lymph nodes begin to basically be utilized to clear all of those catecholamines, they can start to get blocked up. And those are cleared through the contraction of muscles surrounding them. So you have your heart that runs off of electricity to be pumped, like pump your blood throughout your body. Then you have these lymph nodes that are only cleared through the contraction of muscles surrounding them. Well, then we get into the effect that those lymph nodes are also directly tied to your central nervous system. So they have the ability to start to shut those muscles down around them. So if a muscle starts to get shut down due to a lymphatic being clear or being basically backed up, then that muscle is going to begin to slowly shut down. And then if that muscle shuts down, then it's going to build up more. And it kind of turns into a cascade effect. And all of a sudden, you have a major muscles, maybe such as your glute or your psoas, that can no longer do their jobs. So let's say your psoas turns off, and then maybe your rectus femoris, because it crosses at the hip as well, can say, it's okay, I can take care of hip flexion. And then it shortens and tightens itself up. And then your athlete runs into certain dysfunctional patterns, or the glutes can go the other way and through QL or hamstring to complete the hip extension firing. So I think the more that we understand the actual physiology that's creating these patterns, the more that we can basically work in an attempt to create the appropriate patterns at all times within our athletes. And then finally, the other stressful piece, and this kind of fits in as well, is as soon as your body enters that fight or flight, your breathing changes. You're going from a diaphragmatic breath when you're well rest or in a rested position versus as soon as that fight or flight kicks on, your higher centers, so in your brain, takes over, and now you're going through apical breathing, so chest breathing. And the reason that's an issue is that diaphragm that's no longer being utilized in that stressed breathing is tied directly to your psoas. So as those are tied together, they can start to inhibit each other, and then you run into another kind of cascade event. So it's kind of the question of the chicken or the egg. Does the athlete get stressed, and then the lymphatic turns off certain muscles, or is it the actual breathing that controls everything? And we think it's a combination of the two that are going to ultimately lead to those firing patterns, because like I said, your body is so intelligent that it's going to find a way to do things. It's never going to just shut itself down because it says, oh, this muscle isn't working. And with that, there are simple things that we can do in the weight room to ensure that we don't not only continue to reinforce these patterns, but maybe attempt to fix them. The first one and the biggest one is the breathing, the belly breathing. So in through your nose, out through your mouth. That's one thing that we teach our athletes immediately upon them getting on campus. Like we teach them, we just lay them down, one hand on their chest, one hand on their stomach, in through their nose, out through their mouth. And that alone, by teaching them how to breathe appropriately, can assist in reducing those compensation patterns, or at least keep them from getting worse. The RPR component, which Cal's doing a ton with now with Chris Corfist, that could be an entire podcast on its own about the actual points and how you can go in and actually change these compensation patterns in the matter of minutes, honestly, with that nervous system being tied directly to the lymphatics. You can go in and basically become that muscle that's designed to clear that lymphatic out, and then if you manually release that, and then that nervous system can all of a sudden fire. That signal is no longer dampened, so you can see dramatic changes in performance. Whether you want to do just muscle testing, or we've even taken to the point where we've done force plate testing, and the results within minutes are pretty impressive to see an athlete that might have some dysfunction as far as they complete a jump, to what their transfer of force looks like throughout the slope of their jump through their kinetic chain, and you start to see certain issues that match that. You go in and you basically correct them through this method, and then it's an entirely straight line. Like they don't see a dip in a force all of a sudden because they can't transfer energy from one link into the other. So like I said, like that's a huge tool for what we're using now here as well, and that fits into the glute layering model, all of that applied kinesiology, neural lymphatic work like that. And then the other one is movement patterns. So that's great if we can do all of these things to like get them to breathe well. Can we get that muscle to clear out there, or that lymphatic to clear out? But if you're not coaching to an extremely high level, and what is their posture like? That's one thing. And even our interns, when they get here, we tell them that's the first thing they can always cue is like beginning and end range of movement, and what does it look like when they finish? What should it look like? What can we do to ensure that they're moving properly at those points? And then we work through the middle as well. So that cueing, and obviously that's where the art kind of meets the science, like everyone's talking about these days. Like the science is great, but if you can't take it and get your athlete to understand, and it doesn't matter what type of cueing you use, as long as your athletes can feel it and grasp the concept and they can make that happen continuously, then you're going to see a substantial change in those patterns, especially when you add in the appropriate breathing and that RPR.
Yeah, no doubt. Quick follow-up too for you, Matt, is how do you, with the breathing, how do you work that in throughout the course of the session? I believe you do it more than just the beginning. Don't you do that throughout the lifting?
It depends on my teams, but yeah, you can create a response. So for us, with triphasic, you can use it in multiple points. We can use it, like we'll use the actual the RPR piece right into the warm-up, and we'll make sure our guys are breathing then, to get them into a more parasympathetic state where they can actually be focused on what they're doing rather than so stressed out. But we have also used it at the end of, like, let's say a French contrast. So those of you not familiar with the triphasic model setup, the first block is typically, depending on your day, but typically a major movement. So let's say we were going to do a back squat, and if you're doing a muscle action day for strength, or a reactive day for strength, or power, speed, whatever, you're going to complete that movement as prescribed, And then you're going to go into three jumps. And one is a body weight, one is a slightly weighted, and one is an accelerated. And that, again, is all based on transfer of training and the idea. It's kind of the same concept as of throwing a lighter shot put than competition weight, and just slower and just above. Can you get that nervous system to produce force in the manner that it's required in that brief amount of time? So that rate of force development. But then after that, those four movements, we'll typically do a few smaller movements to let our athletes recover, because if we turn around and put them right back under the squat rack or under a squat bar after they've done those jumps, they're not going to make it through very many sets. They might make it through two, or they might get buried under the bar. So after those three jumps, we implement maybe some smaller muscle movements or maybe some prehab work to allow them to recover. And then after that, we've implemented the belly breathing as well. Once again, can you bring your athlete back down very, very rapidly? And that's a huge requirement in repeat sprint sports. The athlete that can produce extremely high levels of force, but then can they also drop themselves down or recover? Because if they can't recover, then they're going to get stuck in a high intensity scenario for the entirety of a game. And by the end, those are going to be your guys, like your twitchy guys experience this the most, that have that trouble recovering, maybe don't have that same first step that they had at the beginning. So teaching your athletes to breathe appropriately, even after certain sets and reps, and using that at appropriate times, or even at the end of a workout, can also be huge for ensuring that on the field, you teach them that skill, that they can begin to utilize that all the time.
Awesome. That's fascinating stuff, Matt. And continuing on along the lines of the glute layering, and you mentioned a little bit in terms of the psoas and the relationship with the rectus femoris and how the rect fem might try to take over when the psoas isn't doing its job. Can you talk a little bit about the glute, hamstring, and QL firing pattern sequence and how that relates, and then a little bit of what you're doing with your glute layering?
Yeah, of course. The glute layering model, really, it boils down to the idea that hip extension and hip flexion are required in every movement. You can't move without some type of hip flexion extension. And we try it all the time. Like you tell that to an intern and they try and find some funky way, but you can't move continuously without that. And with that glute, the optimal firing pattern for that hip extension, what we see in our athletes is actually with the compensation patterns, we don't see it as often. But our goal firing pattern, that optimal, is from the glute to the same side hamstring to that opposite QL. We want our athletes to continuously fire from the inside out to create basically an explosion. We don't want to have that, like we talked about earlier, like that rec fem maybe taking over for that psoas. That's now driving forces back into your hips, into your body, and it creates almost a state of implosion rather than explosion. So when the glutes don't function well, like we talked about this whole time, any type of compensation pattern, the body is going to be intelligent enough to figure out a way around that. So you can have an athlete that fires through their hamstring first, or so they could go hamstring to QL, and then those two drive force back into the glute, and finally the glute picks up. Or you could have an athlete that fires through their QL first, and then it goes hamstring and drives that force into that glute. And it gets really interesting, because when you start to realize these different patterns are occurring, you can test your athletes. First of all, like we take a thumb into the glute and then pinky into that same side hamstring, and then opposite hand or index finger into that opposite QL. And then now all of a sudden you have all three of those muscles, you get your athlete to relax and just have them do a straight leg raise while they're laying on their stomach. And I'll typically even just close my eyes, and you can feel a pattern firing through that. And it's always interesting to see, because when you explain this to coaches, they get their athletes down to try it. And you get a kid that has chronic hamstring issues. Maybe they reach when they run, things like that. But it could also be that hamstring is now firing first, and it has taken over for the hip extension of the glute because the glute can't do its job. Opposite as well, we get this a ton in lacrosse. We get QL drivers are excessive with the rotation required. And we see it in even young athletes. Like the ability to control hip extension through firing of the glutes and not just back extension. So any athlete that all of a sudden thinks they're extending their hips by utilizing their QL and their back extensors to drive forward, they're going to create that pattern that their body says every time they go to extend or utilize their glutes, they're going to use their QL. Those are going to be the guys with the chronic back tightness that have basically two rope erectors down their back because it's driven itself down to change its length tension relationship to now fit the position of the glutes. And all of these just create the patterns that we were talking about earlier. Like they can all be a reasoning that they occur is because of that stress or structure. It could be either of those, and it could be something beyond that as well. But those that misfiring pattern is a huge reason why so much emphasis has been placed on glute activation work and training. So like the glute isos that you see everybody do in their warmups, and that's really what we've done is we've taken something and we go from that structure in our glute layering model from the structure and our RPR to take away those compensation patterns into our glute isos and then finally some 3D contralateral work. And ultimately it's a system that we've created and it's pulled from a ton of different things. Like the glute isos, like I got from the chiropractor here, Nicholas Studholm. He's, like I said earlier, he's one of the best, and it's a privilege to get to work with him. And the structure piece also, he's huge into that. The RPR obviously comes from Cal, who's now kind of taken over that situation. And then the contralateral has been through either Cal, and then we came here and we made it a three-dimensional so we can hit that glute in all three planes, which is Matt Shaw's deal, the director here. He's big into the like we've looked a lot into the Gary Gray, the three-dimensional joint-by-joint approach, and taken that and applied that in the training that we use. So ultimately, the system, it is exactly that. It's a system or a model that is implemented through the use of many other systems to create some type of change in the glutes that ultimately is going to maximize the efficiency and the performance of every athlete in the function of their glutes. And it goes from a very structured standpoint into a full kinetic chain. And like I said, these athletes are experiencing a ton of soft tissue overuse injuries due to improper functioning of their glutes, in our opinion, because now they're having a different driver attempt to create hip extension. That muscle might get overused, or it definitely will get overused, and that major muscle of the glute is no longer doing its job, so that hamstring has to take over, and it turns into another cascade effect where it just wears and tears on that muscle until it just says I can't take it anymore. And I think it's the proof for that has really been with the changes that we've made here in the last year since I've been here, and we went the entire last year with zero missed practices, even for our lacrosse team, due to soft tissue. And I think that's incredible that we can keep our athletes on the field just by checking their basically glute firing pattern and making sure that they are completing the appropriate pattern. And if they're not, we can go in and utilize this system to make sure that we can adjust that and get them firing in the appropriate manner.
Awesome. So going into just a few little nuts and bolts, glute activation has been the rage for some time. And then obviously those of us coaches who are fortunate enough to have chiropractors working with our athletes for the structural aspect, and then as RPR becomes more popular, be activated, and that starts to become more mainstream, and obviously that's an amazing way to reprogram. But just in talking in terms of the glute exercises and activations themselves, what are a few, just for those listening who maybe want to take a couple of things that you found with that, but what are a couple of glute isos that are your favorite in terms of like really good bang for the buck movements that athletes can utilize to improve their glute firing once they do have that programming installed? And I can obviously upload a few in the show notes as well. So what are some of your favorite movements that you're looking at in terms of that?
Yeah, some of the favorite movements that we've used is the fire hydrant. And initially when I introduced this, I kind of discussed a study that they found through 20 minutes of a threshold, I think it was nearly doubled or tripled the actual motor cortex firing or the excitability of the glute, basically. So what they did is they completed a study where they did 20, the people completing it made them do 20 minutes of a glute iso, and they used this fire hydrant. And that's kind of become my favorite because it forces the glutes to fire in all three planes. So you have your abduction, obviously, you have a little bit of extension, and then they also created some rotation by forcing those people to basically rotate at a 45 degrees, not necessarily through moving their hips, but just by changing that firing pattern of the glute. And that one's been instrumental for what we're trying to do. But through that study, they hooked them up to the EMG and measured cortical motor excitability. And what they found is in a matter of 1 week, they can change that drastically. So how this fits into that entire model, that we're making sure that our athletes aren't compensating first, and then we're isolating those glutes out. They'll be reintroduced, obviously, into the entire kinetic chain, because we know without it doesn't work like that. It's not like we put our athletes to get our hamstrings stronger on a single leg hamstring curl anymore. Like, we know that our system is entirely dynamic, but there are certain times, in our opinion, that if we can increase the basically connection at this point between the brain and the glute and max that out, then that's what we're going to try and do. And we've messed around with the same thing. You can do it with any muscles, what they're starting to show now, that if, let's say, you've got somebody returning from an ACL or something along those lines, and you need their quad to pick up, you can use quad iso work and hit that 20-minute threshold, and you're going to create that new, or not new connection, but you're going to strengthen that connection from that brain to that muscle. I think the key, though, is to ensure that those compensation patterns aren't occurring before you begin this, because if they are, you're going to get athletes that all of a sudden come in the next day, and let's say we do 15 to 20 minutes of glute work that we think is glute work and they think is, but they don't have the understanding of what that should feel like or anything along those lines they're compensating, then they're going to come in with the sore back, the sore hamstrings. But the returning to the favorite exercise, the fire hydrant has definitely proven to be my favorite as far as a mid-range or mid-muscle belly exercise. We can also take that one to an extremely shortened state, just by forcing the athlete to push that much harder against. And then another one, I would say, is a cross under lunge. And this is one we get to that's more standing. And our athletes obviously drop into behind, foot behind, a cross under lunge. And now you've created a glute isometric and a lengthened position. So with those holds, and obviously, like, a lot of coaches are doing this already. Like we talked about, so many are utilizing these in their warm-up, things like that. But it's not necessarily 1 minute might not be enough. 1 minute, maybe 1 to 4 minutes is what we use now, that once our athletes have been actually trained in it, as the 1 to 4 minutes might be enough to retain that new increased, basically, cortical motor excitability. But that little amount of time in the warm-up might not be enough to create a substantial change in that connection between the brain and that glute. So that's the first thing. Like these exercises are nothing crazy. We're not reinventing the wheel here. We're just changing how that wheel has been implemented to make sure that we're getting the greatest adaptation possible and still the most efficient way possible. So our progressions for this glute iso, first of all, is, so I have, and I'll send you over the hyperlink for it, but I have all of these up and hyperlinked on my site. It's right now progressions 1 through 5, and we take our athletes through this, and within each of those 5 levels, there are really 3 different progressions that are occurring. The first is the increase in actual isometric time under tension. So as an athlete progresses and they can handle more, basically we give them more. So the tolerance of that. Now, in that study that I mentioned earlier, where they initially found this research of changing the basically strength of that connection, they had those people do a 20-minute hold of the fire hydrant. It was 20 minutes straight. And then they had them do that 3 times a day. So this is a pretty brutal study. And you tell your athletes that they only did one movement 3 times a day for 20 minutes every time, and your athletes will be quiet about their 120-minute session that they have to do of about 8 to 10 different movements. So that's always a good reminder for them to realize that other people are doing this that might not even be in the same athletic position as them. But we also see that we have athletes, even with the correction of compensation patterns, that have never utilized their glutes before. We've got guys that play on U.S. national teams. We have guys that are playing at elite levels, especially in lacrosse here, and we get them down and try and do one isolated movement of their glutes. And it is scary how quickly these guys can burn out, and even just body weight. And all of a sudden, after a minute, they're sitting there shaking because they've never utilized them before. So in our level one, we're still trying to get to that 20-minute threshold time, but we mix in a combination of basically isometric, obviously, and movements as that athlete can tolerate. So let's say we do that fire hydrant that we talked about earlier, and you do a minute each side, and then if they've hit their limit, then you can get them up and you can do, and like I said, I'll send you these hyperlinks so other people can see it, but a cross crawl, it's basically unilateral continuous movement. And why we use those continuous movements is they continue to excite or keep that excitability of the corticomotor system at a high level. Now, you're not going to see improvements in that connection from the brain to that glute necessarily to the same extent if you have to do more and more movement because you're taking away time from your isometrics. But it's a chance to keep that brain engaged while your body is recovering for that next isometric. So as that progression continues from levels 1 through 5, the actual amount of time completed in glute isolated work is increased. Secondly, we move from the ground-based training exercises. So like I was saying, the fire hydrant is on all fours. It's very basic. It's about as far away from a movement required on the field as possible. Like, nobody plays on all fours really in a fire hydrant position or an isolated position or isometric. And then we progress into the standing. So we implement gravity. We want to start isolated, obviously, to get that muscle to actually reconnect with the brain. And then as we progress, we want to get to a full kinetic chain response with the stability required in gravity, because gravity is used in every motion that we complete on the field, on the court, on the ice, whatever it is. So we want to ensure that our athletes have that appropriate transfer of training. And that's one way that we can do it. So and we understand, like, the beginning of this is not in no way specific, but not everything that we're doing has to look exactly like what is being done on the field, as long as we can show that transfer is occurring. So we start in an isolated position and then move to a full kinetic chain, and then we can even move into some of our three-dimensional force producing exercises to ensure that transfer is occurring, that athlete has the use of their glutes, they're still completing movements in the way that we've prescribed, and that's where that cueing comes in to ensure that everything is being completed appropriately. And then finally, the last progression is going to be a change in the muscle length position. So we talked about this briefly with the difference between the fire hydrant and the cross under lunge. How we approach things here, and I don't have necessarily research to support this yet. It's more of a concept or a theory, but we start with mid-range and muscle belly exercises. So that the fire hydrant that we're doing, we're not going to push them to an extreme range of motion yet, because we feel, and those of you that have read the initial triphasic, you can read about the talk of skill learning, and we do it in the new book as well. But the GTOs are already overactive in our opinions. Until you learn a skill extremely well, those GTOs, when you get to end ranges of motion, are so overactive that they're going to reduce some of that force, basically output ability, and that's going to basically reduce performance. So we want to take, and this is, like I said, this is more theory than anything at this point, but we, our progression is from mid-range or mid-belly to try and get some of that stimulus back to the muscle spindles and away from those GTOs. So that's probably the first progression that we would use. And then from there, we work to an extreme shortened and lengthened position of the glutes, because we need our athletes to not only have appropriate firing patterns, things like that, but we need that tissue to tolerate that time under tension that it's going to experience on the field, and it's going to experience all ranges. So we want to have our athletes be as strong as possible at those end ranges of motion. That way, let's say they get there in competition at a really high velocity and they have to all of a sudden throw on the brakes, that they have the strength to slow that muscle down and then keep it within a safe range, and their body has an idea of how to get out of it. And then from there, that shortened and lengthened, we can actually progress. I think it's levels 4 and 5 are full on movement based now. So it's the standing, and instead of maybe just holding for the entire time, it's now glute work, but it's continuous. So you're getting the entire range of motion, training, and strength through that muscle. Just like we talked about earlier with the Olympics, if you're doing your catch at a certain spot, your strength improvement is only specific to that joint angle or that muscle length that you're experiencing. So we want to, yes, we get our mid-belly first, and then we go to our extremes for safety and deceleration, strength, connection. But then we also want to make sure that that strength is experienced throughout the entirety of that glute muscle.
Yeah, that's awesome. And for everyone listening at home too, and I think Matt, you've been really gracious in sharing a lot of these things that are in your manual. And so for those of you who want to go into more depth and kind of see everything and all the pieces of that system, definitely check out the Matt's new book, The Triphasic for Lacrosse. That's a lot of stuff, but just so much great and useful information. It kind of makes me think about some things that I've been doing with swimmers. And when I first discovered RPR, we would use the lats in conjunction with our pull-up days, because we'd try to get the athletes to feel lats more. But just hearing about all of the little the glute things that you're doing on your end, the movements, isometrics, and I've been doing a little bit of movement and isometric based work, but it kind of makes you think like you can almost find the prime movers. Obviously the glutes are a huge one, but some of the other prime movers for sport, and you could use that system on any of them to really optimize that movement flow there.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's where the cueing comes in as well. And that final piece of that glute layering model is really our 3D contralateral that we've implemented. So now it's, can we take that entire kinetic chain and create some type of movement through the glutes, all the way through the lats, QL, hamstring, all the way through that kinetic chain? And can we do that repetitively? So our body basically begins the motor learning pattern of firing glute first every single repetition that we complete. And then there are cues that every coach can use with that to ensure that is, I can't say ensure, but to at least increase the likelihood that the appropriate patterns being used. So the breathing that we talked about is huge. That is absolutely instrumental for ensuring and keeping your athletes in a non-compensated state. So the use of that diaphragm, and it's not necessarily the strengthening of it. It's the fact that your diaphragm might be inactive due to some stressful events or the accumulation of stress throughout throughout life at this point. And a lot of times for our athletes, it's the school, it's the relationships, especially in college, it's money situation, it's anything social media based, like we discussed earlier. But so teaching your athletes to breathe is huge, appropriately. And then the other few are hip extension, and ensuring that as your athlete finishes every movement, when they get to the top, are they getting as tall as possible? Are they squeezing their glutes? Can that athlete begin to feel what that glute squeeze contraction feels like? The other thing, basically a neutral head. So as you complete an RDL, if your athletes are looking at themselves in the mirror at the bottom position, how we always demo it is, if we stand up, we're looking at the ceiling, and that's no longer a neutral head position. And is what that can do is that can create your basically head, neck, and then back to be a driver and you can start to create your hip extension through the pattern of basically QL to hammy to into your glute. And that's one we see pretty commonly, because so many athletes, as they drop in, they naturally keep their head up. So they're basically looking at themselves or in the mirror or whatever, or looking straight down the turf for us or across to another platform. And that's been a huge piece that we've had to work on correcting, because it's so natural and it's so commonly overlooked. But we find the more and more that our kids do that, are the ones that have trouble actually finding their glute and hip extension, and even doing simple movements like our glute isos. They're the ones that, let's say we're doing a single leg hip bridge, all of a sudden want to do a basically a back extension, and their glutes are basically turned off for the entirety of that minute each side. And then finally, the drive through the big toe has been another cool one to see. With the connection, you can fire your big or your glute more rapidly and more forcefully by gripping the ground with that big toe, because that's going to transfer that force up that chain more efficiently, basically, than leaving that foot or that big toe in a loose position.
Yeah. And I was just thinking too, and when I talked just about specifically another muscle group too, you, every time you go outside the glutes, you got to remember that, yeah, Douglas Hill zone one rule, you know, you got to make sure that inner unit and glute psoas is working first, and then work your way outwards and all the connections, therein.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So Matt, I got one more question for you, and you already alluded to it a little bit, before, but you're talking about triplanar movement. And you were talking about your cross under lunge, and could you talk, go into a little bit more depth about some of the rationale for the triplanar movements, working in, especially like working the transverse plane, and then some of the movement types that might load the muscles and tissues more specifically to the forces that they're going to encounter in sport, and the way that this can better our strength practice.
Yeah, the triplanar loading principle is really where we got the – I shouldn't say we. It's where Matt Shaw and Dr. Studholm, our chiropractor, have really worked with the Gary Gray and that PT aspect of things to bring that right into our strength and conditioning practices. But the triplanar loading is the idea that every single step that's taken – there are joints functioning in each of the three ranges of motion. So as you take a step forward and you're rolling over that ankle, you have your dorsiflexion, which everyone understands. It's a sagittal movement. We get that one. But you're also getting subtalar eversion, which causes your foot to basically, your arch to basically slightly collapse. And that can be your frontal movement. So every step you take, that arch just slightly, and now your athletes that can't control it are going to experience this to a greater extent, right? But slightly drives in to that pronation. Well, that pronation through that arch creates a tibial rotation. So that tibia has to follow, because it sits right on top of the subtalar joint, has to follow that subtalar joint in as it everts. And then that drives your femur to internally rotate. And then that creates an eccentric loading on your glutes. So with every step, that's how we are getting those glutes to fire first. That it, and you find a lot of your athletes don't have that ability. So all of that glute layering model stuff, it's great. And it's an extremely top-down approach. So it's brain to glute. Brain to glute. Can we get to the hip to fire in this pattern, and over and over and over again? But then we also have to take the bottom-up approach and say, all right, is that foot functioning appropriately? Can we get through our appropriate range of ankle dorsiflexion in order to allow that basically subtalar eversion and then tibial medial rotation that will eventually lead to those glutes eccentrically loading and then concentrically pushing you through. And we tell our athletes all the time, if you have, and basically quote unquote, if you have dumb feet that can't play the game of telephone up to those glutes, then you're going to run into problems as you cannot load appropriately.
Yeah, no doubt. So how do you, In terms of some of the exercises you utilize and the way that you teach those and work those, do you, I think you've mentioned a little bit about having athletes in not traditional sagittal loading positions, like the cross under lunge, for example.
Yeah, and for us, we start entirely in the warm-up. We want to start in the warm-up, give our athletes proprioceptive abilities in non-loaded positions, and then once they get used to that, basically, and understand how to what that should feel like, how to utilize them, then we can progress into that. But so some really basic examples, and I can send links for all these, but we use like a tee-up or a pivot drill. So let's say left foot stays flat on the ground. You're going to take your right foot and basically create a T in the front, and then you're going to rotate to drive a T at the back. And what that will do as your athlete takes that step forward, if you teach them how to corkscrew themselves into the ground, maintaining that big toe driven down, you can actually start to create subtalar and midfoot movement, which is what we want. Obviously, in that triplanar loading, that's the first step when that foot strikes. Besides ankle dorsiflexion, which obviously I would assume the majority of coaches are training at this point, but that tee up can assist with that and create that not only ability but also that proprioceptive feel for our athletes. The lateral to cross under lunge. So as we complete a lateral lunge, basically you're having one hip of the leg extended, is experiencing relative hip adduction. As it is extended away from the body. And it's also, if you cue your athletes to keep their feet flat, it's experiencing that ankle inversion. Then, if they transfer into that cross under lunge, the hip is now experiencing relative hip external rotation, adduction, as well as ankle eversion as that foot stays flat. Other movements that we use, we'll use a staggered stance squat. So just by changing those feet from a neutral to now staggered, even like a toe-to-heel relationship, we can change the rate at which ankle dorsiflexion occurs. So if you stand up and you try that and you stagger your feet, keep your toes pointed straight ahead, keep your feet heels flat, then you can feel the basically rate of ankle dorsiflexion in that back leg. It occurs at a much greater extent than the front leg. And that's a really simple tool we can use to assess basically an athlete's ability to dorsiflex. Or we can go into a staggered stance three-way RDL. And that's just going to be still staggered stance, feet stay flat, but now you're going to hit basically those hamstrings in three different directions, and you can start to hit, feel your athletes will basically feel that stretch in different places as you prepare them for the training session or a competition, whatever it is. Kneeling three-way hip flexor, same idea. Hip flexor in these three different, basically not fully planes of motion because there's no true rotation, but you can get it at different angles to basically warm that hip flexor up. You can change your driver. So let's say you add an arm reach, and all of a sudden you can get an increased range of motion or an increased stretch on a certain muscle that you might not get before. So one that we always start with our interns here is a rotational reach pattern. So if you just stand there and you have feet straight ahead, about shoulder width apart, and you reach around one side as far as possible, you should be able to feel that subtalar joint rotate, that tibia rotate of that foot as you progress through that movement. It's can you link everything in your body as you try and look as far basically around the corner as possible as you complete that rotation. And ultimately in the warm-up, you got to think bang for your buck. So that's where we came up with like the lateral to cross under lunge. Like we can get our athletes through that very quickly. A rotational lunge, things along those lines that can get our athletes to not only feel the movement, but we can complete it to a really high level at a quick pace so we can get right into the training sessions. In the training sessions, we'll use some exercises. Like our favorite at this point is for entire kinetic chain work is a split stance cable rotational row. And how we teach that is we have our athletes basically facing our cable. It's a pull from low to high. And I can send a video of this too, I guess. But we slightly internally rotate the front foot and you reach down, and by internally rotating that foot, you're already creating an eccentric stretch or loading in that front foot glute. Then you're thinking about basically starting a giant lawnmower as you extend your leg, drive through, and then rotate your hips around while you row that cable up to your armpit. You have now fired your glutes in all three patterns. You have the extension, you have the abduction, and you've completed the rotation. And this is where we link that transfer of training. We talked about the glute layering model as far as, okay, yeah, you do some banded 3D contralateral work, but what does that mean for force production? Well, this is your chance for your athlete to see, can I utilize the entire kinetic chain from that subtalar joint to tibial medial rotation to glute rotation, abduction, extension, all the way up to that opposite QL and that opposite lat, completing the movement through. And what's great about, we can go into some other ones like a cable pull to press. You'd be facing laterally to the cable, and you're basically going to go low to high, and you create that same rotation, but now in a double leg setting. Or a glute wind up, we can go like a staggered stance, and basically you corkscrew yourself around that glute so you can feel that hip load up. It's basically like the next step of the cross under lunge, basically, or that triplanar loading. You're feeling that glute eccentrically load, and then you can either take it to just a knee drive through, you can take it all the way to a jump, and you can progress all of those things. Or another really common one is the common lunge matrix. You have your forward lunge to a lateral lunge to a rotational lunge. Well, we can take that and we can go to single leg decels, to hops, to all of these different planes of motion that we don't normally hit, but that rotational jump is now basically the speed version that we can utilize from that split stance cable rotational row. Now you're taking out the actual rowing component, but now it's a movement that your athletes complete all the time. If they have to open their hips and drive and sprint down to whatever it is, that they can now complete that movement, and they have the appropriate proprioception from starting from the ground all the way up to those hips, and they have also done the glute layering model, so that brain is connected to those glutes at a high level, and they can complete that in the most efficient and powerful manner possible. And that's why we like these, is that you can improve rate of force development. You can even work some peak force in some of these movements. Rate of force acceptance, if we do some deceleration, especially in our single leg decels, as far as that common lunge matrix. We can train disadvantageous positions. That's another thing that we've worked with our athletes. So when our athletes get on the field, if they get into some kind of funky situations with their body, we've given them basically what we would call like a small dose of venom, basically, or we've given them the situational awareness to be able to pull themselves out of that awkward position. So, like for an example, on that common lunge matrix, let's say we're just doing a lunge forward. We'll get our athletes to learn how to decelerate with that toe externally rotated, and that drives that knee into a relative valgus position. Now, we don't do this at extreme speeds or forces, but it's just a little neural drive to that athlete for them to say, okay, I've been here before. So if they end up there in the competition field, they can now create a strategy to get back out of it. We've provided that stimulus for them. And that's kind of what this all boils down to. There's no, I don't want to say there's ever any magical exercise. There's no such thing. There's ways to progress different movements. And it's more about selecting appropriate exercises that you can transfer. Can you take something from a ground-based all the way to now a warm-up based into a force production-based, not only strength, but also power and then speed, and then right onto the field. So it's the patterning of that hip extension, or the patterning of the creating an explosive state versus an implosive state, the joint by joint approach, but all of these, and the multidimensional training. But these are all reasons that we've started to shy away, like we talked about at the beginning, from those Olympic movements, and we don't use them as often because we don't feel that we can transfer them at the greatest extent like we can with some of these movements, and truly create that function on the field at a really high level.
Yeah, no doubt. You probably wouldn't want to do a clean with your feet pre-rotated or something like that.
No,
Your hips pre-rotated
we
would be a
always
bad
make the
idea.
joke that we're gonna add in the rotational deadlift at some point, but that one's still a little ways off. It's in the making.
Yeah. Well, send me a video when you have that out there.
I'll get a good friend to try that one. I won't be trying that one personally.
Yeah, probably not the athletes either.
Yeah, probably.
It reminds me, some of the stuff you talked about reminds me a little bit. I've seen work with breaststrokers and swimming. They got some crazy squats they do that you'd think their knees are going to explode, but it's done in a dose that they can handle it. No one seems to complain. So it kind of,
we were doing a glute iso work this morning. Actually, swimming had kind of a download lift, and one of the girls externally rotated her foot to the point where it was back to almost touching her hip. But above it and to the side, and I was like, okay, you gotta stop this right now. That's ridiculous.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. But yeah, totally. I think there's just so many great applications with there. You know, a lot of people, when this whole sports specific vibe comes up, sometimes people get these kind of almost bad ideas of people playing around on BOSU balls. But just with everything you talk about, that there is so much depth and so much complexity, but also functionality of the system. It's not it's just so the way that you've integrated it, I think, makes so much sense, and a lot of coaches can really benefit from it. So that's all the time I have for the show for today, Matt, but thank you so much for your time. Your answers were just incredible depth, and I'm really excited to link all these videos up so that coaches can and athletes at home can really get a lot more out of the things you've said. So thank you so much for your time.
Of course. Thanks, Joel.
That does it for the show this week. Thank you so much for tuning in. Matt was just such a great guest to have. There's so much great information that he relayed to us. And again, please be sure to check out those show notes, as it definitely puts a lot of what he was saying into a visual context there. Please be sure to check out our sponsor, simplyfaster.com, suppliers of high-end speed training technology such as the K-Box, Freelap Timing System, GymAware, and SpeedMat. SpeedMat, I've been using and loving it. So be sure to check those guys out. And we'll be coming back at you next week with another great show. We'll see you then.